Konnichiwa, halfway history, e yokoso. Watashi wa Jonathan.
I hate you.
Watashi wa Jonathan.
Watashi wa Kylie.
And this is a show that is sometimes about this week in history, but this time we're giving you a little bit of a bonus episode as we went to Japan for like 3 weeks, if you couldn't tell by the intro there. And we just wanted to let you know about what our trip in Japan was like. And we got a few like fun facts throughout, if they're not just regular fun facts from us chatting about it, but we wrote down some fun facts to pop in.
Yes.
So, just right at the top, this is going to be the last episode for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to come back. We just need more time to do notes again because yep. Kylie's back in teaching mode.
Yeah.
And gotta keep working on those curriculum.
My brain can only handle so much at once.
Yeah, so this is definitely not goodbye.
No.
We will see you again very soon.
Yes, we will see you very, very well. Well, you'll hear us
very soon. Don't
say very,
very soon.
I said you'll hear us very soon.
Uh-huh.
Hopefully.
Okay, so how do we want to kick this off? Do we just want to talk about just in order different things we did and
sure.
just chat?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it started off with the longest flight ever.
Yeah, I am not built for 20-hour flights.
No.
I'm not.
I mean, I don't think anyone is,
yeah.
genuinely.
It was very uncomfortable.
We went to Hawaii for the first time, even though it was only for, what, like 2.5 hours?
Yep. And then on the way back, we went to Hawaii for another...
Like 4.5 hours. Yeah.
Half hours. So we've spent about 6 hours in Hawaii.
Woohoo!
We got 2 trips out of it, really, if you think about it that way.
If we had planned better, we could have, like, spent a day there or something, but, like, nah.
That would have been so expensive and so much...
I know.
Anxiety? Lots of anxiety around doing that?
Fair.
Uh-huh.
Definitely fair, yeah. So once we got there, we got a taxi, which was awesome. Pretty easy. We went to the wrong place.
Well, I'm not sure getting the taxi was awesome and easy. Like, we got onto a taxi. We showed the taxi person where we needed to go, and it turns out that there's a bunch of this little, like, Airbnb that we went
to
that are kind of scattered all over the area.
Yeah.
And he saw the name of it, knew where one of them was, and brought us to one of them, which was not ours. And
right.
Kylie had a panic attack just immediately because we get to the place, our reservation says that we're on the second floor, and this building has a first floor, a third floor, and a fourth floor.
So it was actually that we had room 203. There was a room 201 and a room 202, but there was no 203 to be found. So
yeah.
I was wondering if there was like another part that we didn't see or something like that.
We walked around the block a few times
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I asked Kylie to like look at the reservation, and our lovely, lovely service provider, Verizon, when we activated our roaming, it didn't come on. It just didn't work.
It just did not work at all.
Yep. So we had to go off memory, and Kylie was like, I remember that the person told me that this place was next to a laundromat.
Mm-hmm.
So we walked around the block looking for laundromats, but it was also very late at night.
And it looked very residential.
Yeah. So there was like one spot that I was like, this might be a laundromat. And then we overheard a couple arguing in that building and we're like, nope, that's not a laundromat.
In all reality, I'm pretty sure we were just like peeping Tom into someone's house. And I kind of feel bad about that.
I never saw any other houses that looked like that one, though. That was definitely supposed to be, at least the first floor was supposed to be a storefront.
Okay. Well, I feel slightly better about that then.
Yeah.
And then some very kind person who spoke no English took it upon themselves to help us. As I'm like crying in the middle of the street, it was really embarrassing. He flagged us down a taxi. My phone wasn't working. So I was like, this is the address, but we're supposed to be in, like, this is where we're supposed to be, right? And he's like, oh no, you're in the wrong town, essentially. And we're like, oh,
yeah, I think
okay.
It was like Aizakawa or Arakawa or whatever in Shinjuku,
yeah.
And we were supposed to be in Kabukicho.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, this is not there.
Yeah, he's like, and like he was able to be like, it's like 15 minutes because his Google Translate worked. Ours was not functioning.
Right.
So he got us a taxi. He made sure, he spent like 5 minutes making sure the taxi driver was going to take us to the right place.
Yeah, because when he went to go look up the, once he figured out, because he originally just like walked us around the corner and was like, ta-da, the place
yeah,
that you're staying.
And we're like, no, it's not that one.
And when he looked up, he was like, oh, there's, he looked at it and he's like, oh, there's a lot of them. And he's like, which one? And we eventually got,
figured out how to get
to Kabukicho. So that was our very eventful first night.
Mind you, it's like midnight at this point.
Yeah.
Because we didn't get there until like, it was like 8, we landed at like 8:30 their time, which is like 7:30 a.m. our time. And then it took us a while to figure out like getting the Suica card and getting the taxi and everything and then getting to where we ended up going. And then realizing we were in the wrong place and having to go to the other place. So it was like 11 o'clock or something.
Yeah, it was late.
It was late. And I was anxious.
She was not having it.
I was not having it.
It was not a good first hour in Japan for Kylie.
On the bright side, though, that was like the major error that happened while we were on this trip.
Yeah, that was the only thing that like really went wrong in the sense of us trying to get around Japan. Otherwise, it was extremely easy.
Yeah, so I guess this just means that when you go to Japan, take public transit. Don't take the taxi.
Yeah, the taxi will just drop you off where they think you're supposed to go.
Yeah, so public transit.
Yeah, we just didn't take the public transit that night because there was something happening on the Yamanote line that was going to make it like a two-hour train
ride.
Yeah,
there was a delay.
Yeah, there was some big delay that night, and we never experienced any other delays on the public transit while we were there.
Yeah, but I did, every time we were on public transit, though, I always saw the like rotating screen always was like saying that there were delays on certain lines, even the one that we were on.
Right.
But we never experienced it because their trains come so frequently.
Right. But that night was different because it was the Google Maps while we were still in the airport because we had Wi-Fi there.
Yeah.
The Google Maps was saying it was going to take forever.
That's
which
true, yeah.
That never happened before.
Yeah.
Or after, I should say.
Yeah, before.
Yeah. That never happened after that point.
Yeah. So there must have been something wonky going on with that. But we did eventually make it, and we slept hard.
Yes, especially because we had been up like 24 hours.
Like, no, it had been like almost 48 hours at that point.
Yeah, it was a long time.
Yeah, so like our flight left at like 9 a.m., I think, in the morning.
We got there at like 9 p.m. the next day.
Something like that. Yes, yeah, exactly. Yep. So like it was a full day at plus of travel.
Yeah. So we got to our hotel, which was definitely next to a very clear
laundromat. Mm-hmm.
They had a lot of signs. And that's when our trip really started.
Yes.
Or so we thought. We had one very good day the next day, just like wandering around, finding a bunch of food. And we got up like super early to go and make sure we had enough time to see everything. Because everything we've seen online is that Tokyo, because we were in Shinjuku, which is part of Tokyo, Tokyo metropolitan area, not Tokyo City. And we got up early to go do a whole bunch of things. And it turns out Japanese people don't do anything until 11 o'clock.
Nothing was open.
Yep.
There was like two things. It was like the donkey and like the one place that we found that like catered to tourists.
The donkey being Don Quixote, which is a superstore of sorts that they
like Walmart on steroids.
Yeah. It's everything you could possibly imagine existed in the Don Quixote, which the locals called the donkey.
And it has this really funny looking penguin as its mascot.
Yep.
Which is even better. It's adorable.
There was also like one of them that we walked by where we didn't know it was a donkey. And we were like, whoa, they got all these like tropical fish just like
out
on the road.
It was really funny because it was like a side entrance to the donkey we had been to multiple times.
Right. It's just
we
not just one we ran into.
Never been through that entrance.
Yeah. They had like angelfish and clownfish and the little like blue fish that are whatever Dory is
Dory's,
in Finding Nemo.
Yeah.
I forget what they are.
I don't remember. I don't think I ever knew what
they were. Live anemones and these just big tanks right at the entrance.
Just chilling. And I'm like, how are they not baking?
Oh, yeah.
How are the tanks not boiling? Because.
Yep. You can go ahead.
It was like 100 plus degrees every day.
Yeah. So we went in August. This
Which
is like
a
little bit, you know, delayed since then because we got back, relaxed, tried to recuperate before we got back into
recording. I started up school again. And
yeah.
Oh, boy.
So I've always known that Japan is on a similar seasonal cycle to New England,
mm-hmm.
which it is. It's just their summers are much hotter, or at least they're just as hot as New England summers used to be before climate change.
Yeah, yeah. And
we were
humid.
Unprepared.
They were. It was fairly humid a lot of the time.
Yeah, most days we would leave our Arctic tundra of an Airbnb because we
Jonathan's
turned
a monster.
Down. Yeah, and I love the cold. And we would leave, and my glasses would not just fog up, but like immediately start raining. Like they would get so foggy that the condensation would start dripping off of them nearly immediately.
It felt like you ran into a wall every time you went outside of an air conditioned anything.
It was
like. Even leaving, like, an air-conditioned building,
yeah.
It was, like, hitting a brick wall of heat and humidity.
Speaking of, they absolutely know that, and the donkey was our best friend for another reason, because as we were exploring anywhere in the city, if you walk even remotely close to the entrance of a donkey,
oh my God.
They are just pumping out AC.
Yes.
Because the donkey doesn't actually have, like, closed doors on their main entrance. It's just open air.
I'm pretty sure they're 24/7, and that's why.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you would just walk anywhere near one and you could just kind of pause and be like, oh my gosh, yes, air conditioning. Oh my gosh, yes.
Thank God, a break. Thank God. And like, there's not very much like public seating out there. Like benches were not really a thing.
Yeah, there were not a lot of benches unless you were like in a public park type place.
Yeah, public parks had
benches. Or like waiting for a train, or like a bus, but we weren't even really doing that.
Most of the bus stations did not have benches either.
So yeah, a couple of them did, but yeah, no, you're right. For the most part, they didn't.
But we never did buses. We did train the whole time because I guess we can talk about the public transportation. Actually, no, hold on. We had that one really fun day where we saw a bunch of things, ate a bunch of food, had a good time. I got a fever. I had the flu for 4 days straight after that.
Yeah. So I got to explore Kabukicho all on my own some. It was fun.
Yeah. So poor Kylie did that. It was like the day after I thought I was like better.
Yeah,
from
we
the
went
flu.
And got lunch and then you were immediately like, I'm dying.
Yeah, I'm like, we need to get back because everything hurts. But it was weird. It was like I didn't feel like too like ill, like the classic cold, gross feeling.
Yeah.
I was just constantly cycling between hot and cold, and it was super nauseating doing that.
I'd get back from doing, like, going to get lunch or, like, getting whatever, and he'd be like, can we turn the AC off? I'm like, if you do, I will end you. You may not, sir. I just got back, and it is barely making me no longer a sweaty mess. I took more showers on this trip than I think I ever have in my life.
Yeah.
Like, in combination. I'm pretty sure I showered at least twice every day, probably more. Like, every time I came back from doing anything, I was like, gotta get in the shower. I am so sweaty. It was awful.
Mm-hmm. At least the showers were, like, super nice, and they have that little, we kept calling it the old people shower head because you could
the,
take it off the wall.
Yeah, shower head. That was super nice.
Yep.
I liked that. I definitely want one now.
That absolutely turned me around on old people shower heads. That was so convenient.
Can we talk about, so our Airbnb did not have the cool Japanese toilets, but literally everywhere else did.
It had a kind of cool toilet. It had the large and small flush, which I had never seen before.
Yeah, that was cool. I've actually seen that in some public restrooms in the U.S. too now.
Oh.
So that is very cool, but it did not have the heated seats. It did not have the noise function. It didn't have the washer, the bidet function,
mm-hmm.
or the air drying function, which as a female was the most amazing part of this thing, was that you could just blow dry your butt.
Uh-huh.
It was awesome. Also, the sound thing where no one has to hear you use the bathroom. It was just like white noise. You push a button, it just makes a quiet white noise. You can adjust the volume. Perfection.
Yeah, bathrooms were cool. They weren't, if you've never left the U.S. before, the U.S. has a thing that people call hostile architecture.
Oh,
I mean,
God.
There's other countries use hostile architecture in different ways, but the U.S. specifically is kind of notorious for using hostile architecture in bathrooms. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, it's the huge gaps in the doors of the stalls.
Where,
and
like, you can literally have, like, a full view of the person using the restroom if you're at the correct angle. Because the U.S. is horrible.
Yeah, and, like, not having super great locks and having that huge gap in the bottom of the door.
Where children can literally climb underneath, look at you and go, you're not my mom. And I'm like, Nope, but you just hold some, a whole downstairs situation, so thank you.
Although I do get a large kick out of every, like, video I see online that people go around with yellow-colored water bottles and squirt people under the under the stalls.
Oh, that's horrible.
Oh, my God, it makes me laugh so much every time.
Mean.
But it's terrible. And it's,
that's so mean. Yeah. Oh, my God, I'd probably, like, have a heart attack.
So Japan didn't have any of that. All of their bathrooms were designed for, like, comfort and privacy in mind.
Yeah. Yeah,
that was nice.
So that, like, you can, you know, poop in peace. It would have been nice.
Uh-huh.
So that was wonderful. And all the doors had, like, the little, like, airplane thing where when you turn the lock, it says occupied. Like, how hard is that? It's not.
It also sounds like the men's and women's bathrooms in Japan are very similar in quality, where that is not typically the case in the
true,
U.S.
True, yes. Yeah, that
men's,
is very
men's
true.
Bathrooms tend to be pretty lacking.
That's, yeah. I mean, having never been in a men's bathroom, I can't say for sure, but I will take your word for it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we explored the bathrooms. Kylie discovered the majesty that is the Japanese toilet.
She keeps sending me links to ones that she wants to buy for us now.
Yes, yes, I have. And they're, like, just, like, little attachments that you put on the top of your, they're, like, you replace your existing toilet seat with. That is just, and then you plug it in. I don't see a downside.
Uh-huh.
Other than the cost. Then what did we do? After you got ill forever.
So after I got better is when our buddy Luis came.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
he came on a flight a few days after we did.
Yeah.
So I got better just for when he got there. And that was also, thankfully, right before we went to our hot spring resort. Because
yeah.
we reserved a few days at a hot spring resort. And that was so much fun. And, like, the hot spring had, I don't know how much, Kylie has some fun facts about hot springs that she's about to go into. But it was super cool to go to a resort that's for hot springs. And, like, I feel like if it were in the U.S., it's just like, oh, you know, here's your hotel room and you can go and visit the hot spring jacuzzi, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
This place had a hot spring in every room.
Yes.
And then also multiple public hot springs with, like, different layouts and stuff that you
yeah.
could go visit.
And, like, different views and stuff.
Yeah.
It was really cool. There was, like, a rooftop one that was just, like, open to the upper air and everything. And then there was one on, like, one of the higher floors, but it wasn't open on the top, like, it wasn't on the roof,
mm-hmm.
but it had, like, a beautiful view because of, like, the one that we went to was right on the Ito Peninsula, so
yep.
it was, like, right on the ocean, gorgeous. So it had fantastic views, and then, like, I know you mentioned you guys tried the steam room.
Yep.
I didn't try the steam room. I found this weird in the women's one. So the way it's currently set up, at least where we went, it was, like, each of them switched, like, at certain times of day, so, like, if you went in the morning, you might use the one on the right as a woman. And then you might use the one on the left later in the day as a woman, which would have, like, a slightly different layout, slightly different view. I didn't go in the steam room or look for it, really. But I did find in the one that I went in this funky, like, I want to call it waterfall room because it was, like, a bunch of lawn chairs set up under, like, essentially just, like, faucets that poured water directly down onto the chair, and you could just sit in it and just have water hit you.
Yeah, ours didn't have that. It had something similar where it was like a pool where there was a pipe that was a wider pipe with a waterfall coming out, and you could sit at the bottom of the pool, but
yeah.
there wasn't any chairs. It was just part of the regular bath. It was
yeah,
part
no,
of the
this
hot
was
spring.
This was, like, a separate, like, almost like a shower room. But it just had these, like, faucets that had, like, little mini waterfalls. It was very cool.
We had an extremely fun experience using the sauna room because it's a dry sauna.
Mm-hmm.
So it's extremely hot, but you can still breathe because it's a dry sauna. Like, I can't breathe in the wet saunas, the steam ones.
Remember that one time we went and did, like, a couples massage and then we used the sauna on our, like, little mini honeymoon?
Yeah, you lasted seconds.
I lasted seconds before I was like, if I stay in here any longer, I'm going to have an asthma attack.
Yeah.
I could not breathe. I could not get breath in, and I couldn't, like, my lungs were like, oh, we're closing up now. And I'm like, no, stop doing that.
Yeah, so the dry saunas in the men's area, they were 96 degrees C, which is huge because as you go up in C, it goes faster than Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm.
It was extremely hot. We sat in there. You're supposed to sit in there for 12 minutes. We assume you're supposed to sit in there for 12 minutes because they have a clock on the wall that that goes full circle in a 12-minute interval.
Oh, interesting.
So we sat in there for the 12 minutes, and then as soon as you leave, there's a bath before you exit the sauna because you just got all sweaty that you're supposed to rinse off in. Mm-hmm. And Luis gets in it and just almost immediately screams because it's an ice bath that you're supposed to take after coming out of the sauna. So we're just like both sitting there just just like hyperventilating in this ice bath, like trying to get all the sweat off us so we can go back into regular onsen, which I'm assuming That's Kylie funny. May talk yes. about. But there's a lot of cleanliness rules around using hot springs in Japan, which yes. is funny because coming from America, like you just hop in pools when you're sweaty and you don't take a shower to take a bath, but like that's a big thing there.
Yeah. And I mean, like sometimes hotel pools will have like a please rinse off before you get in the tub, in the swimming pool, but no one ever does it.
Yeah.
Like, that is not something that anyone ever follows.
This is heavily enforced
yes.
in Japan.
Yeah.
Not like, you know, physically, but there's signs everywhere in, like, that is what you do. And, like, we watched, like, all the locals were doing it. So mm-hmm. it was like, okay, this is a real thing that is culturally significant to them, not just, you know, if you're being kind kind of a thing.
Yeah. Okay, so I do have some notes about bathhouses, also called sentos, and bathing culture in general in Japan.
Cool.
So the history of bathing in Japan dates back to the 6th century with the introduction of Buddhism, and it was believed to not only wash the body, but also to cleanse the spirit and improve one's health. In Buddhism, the casting aside of all impurities is an important act of devotion for followers, and it's considered a virtue, and many temples therefore had baths for this purpose. And they were called yuyas at first. Which I thought was a fun word.
I wonder if that has anything to do with the fact that the bathrobes are called yukatas.
Ooh, maybe. So it was thought that by bathing, one casted off the 7 ailments that and take the 7 blessings outlined in the Buddhist teachings. Many visitors made the trip to temples for this purpose alone. And at this point, it's also really likely that some people started to visit temples simply to enjoy taking a bath, which would have been me. These baths were most often steam baths, so think more like a sauna than like an actual bathtub now.
Yep.
So early bathhouses were much different from what they are today. They were mixed gender. Each customer received an allotment of hot water, and the baths were more like steam rooms today, like I said.
Mm-hmm. So you take that allotment of hot water and you would probably put it on like the burning charcoals or whatever to make it steam more.
Right. There were also very small openings like to these rooms, about 80 centimeters, so that heat wouldn't escape. And it was like just big enough for someone to fit through.
Someone's.
So they were really dark. And customers would often clear their throats to signal that where they were to other people because you couldn't see them. Don't want to sit down and sit down on top of someone. So, it was common practice when someone entered the steam room to, like, make a little bit of a noise that people knew where you were. So, during the Edo period, the Tokugawa shogunate required baths to be segregated by sex in order to ensure public moral standards. However, many bathhouse owners merely partitioned their bath with, like, small boards or like the tatami paper and stuff,
yep.
Which allowed for voyeurism to occasionally persist mm-hmm. because some people are horrible. Other baths avoided this problem by having men and women bathe at different times of day or by catering to one gender exclusively, so women only or men only.
Mm-hmm.
In spite of this, laws regarding mixed-sex bathing were eventually relaxed over time. So contributing to the popularity of public baths in the Edo period were female bathing attendants known as yuna. These attendants helped cleanse customers by scrubbing their backs, and after official closing hours, a number of these women would perform additional services, if you know what I mean.
Oh.
And some modern brothels, called sopu rando or soaplands, would have women who specialize in bathing with and cleansing male clientele.
So sopu rando is literally just the Japanese way of saying the English word soapland.
Yep. Mixed gender bathing was prohibited once again after Commodore Perry visited Japan in 1853, and then again in 1854, because he had questions about the morality of said practice, even though it's not his culture and it's really none of his business.
Mm-hmm. I think we're going to go to, after you finish this, we're going to hop over to one of the like quick fun facts that I found, because I found something very interesting about just sex work culture in general.
Oh, okay.
And it's not anything to do with what when we were in Kabukicho.
Okay.
So.
So during the Meiji period, which was 1867 to 1912, bathhouses changed considerably, most noticeably focusing on sunken bathtubs and high ceilings, which allowed for windows.
Mm-hmm.
Or open walls, which was great. The only difference between these baths and the modern bath was the use of wood for the bathing area and the lack of faucets. So when we were at our onsen, the in-room bath was a wooden bath. So it's like a wooden bathtub. So that is actually like the more authentic version than like the sunken like rock kind of thing.
And I don't know how it did it. I think it can't be weight, because it would, you know, when you're in it, you would weigh a whole lot more. Or actually maybe weight is the way it does it. But it always seemed to know how to keep the tub level while we were in it. And I just did not know how it was doing that. And like, as soon as you would get out, it would, the like faucet would go into overtime to refill the tub.
Yeah, and it would fill itself back up. Yeah. And the water was constantly like draining out and refreshing too.
Yeah.
Which was really nice.
So it has to do with weight, but I didn't know how they were doing it.
Yeah, that's fair. Lack of faucets. Additionally, another law for segregated bathing was passed in 1890, which allowed only children below the age of 8 to join a parent of the opposite gender. So, like, if, like, you had a kid with you, but they were a boy, if they were 8 or older, they had to go into the men's one by themselves.
Yep.
They couldn't go with their parent. So, at the beginning of the Taisho period, so 1912 to, like, 1926, tiles replaced wooden floors and walls in the new bathhouses. Unfortunately, on September 1st, 1923, the Great Kanto earthquake devastated Tokyo. The earthquake and the subsequent fire destroyed most of the bathhouses in the Tokyo area. This accelerated the change from wooden baths to tiled baths, as most new bathhouses that were built were using the new style. And these ones included faucets.
Ah.
Which is my favorite part, because that's like how the little like waterfall thing happens.
Right.
So during World War II, many Japanese cities were damaged along with most buildings and baths, both public and private. So this lack of baths caused the reappearance of the communal bathing, and temporary bathhouses were constructed with whatever available material there was. And they often lacked a roof. Because, like, why bother if you're barely scraping together enough material to make the bath?
Mm-hmm.
So as few people had access to private baths at this time, there was a huge increase in customers for the bathhouses. The number of public baths in Japan peaked around 1970, after which most buildings that had been built or were being built included a bath or shower in every apartment unit. So sentos are a little different from onsens. Onsens are hot springs and the bathing facilities and traditional inns that surround them. There are approximately 25,000 hot spring sources throughout Japan, and approximately 3,000 onsen establishments use this naturally sourced hot water from geothermally heated springs. Onsens may be either outdoor, which are rotenburo, or indoor, which is uchiyu.
Uchiyu. That's a fun word.
Learning more Japanese doing these notes. We're there. So the Japanese Hot Springs Act regulates the temperature and the amounts of specific minerals that need to be present. So sulfur, sodium, iron, and magnesium. When onsen water contains distinctive materials or chemicals, establishments often will display what type of water it is. So if it's sulfur heavy or iron heavy or whatever. In part because of the specific mineral found in the water is thought to have specific health benefits.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if you have one particular ailment, you might steer towards, like, a salt-heavy bath. Or if you have a different thing, you might go more towards, like, a sulfur-rich one.
Quick thing about the ailments, because I had a bone to pick with these bathhouses about these ailments. Because all of the places that we were looking up, they were always front and center saying that this natural hot spring, this natural onsen, is best for people with this ailment and that ailment and blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. And then when you get to the end of the page on that same website, it would say, do not come to the bathhouses if you have these ailments. And it's like, they never really prefaced it as like, historically we did this. It was telling you as if, oh, you should come here because you have some sort of skin disease and this water will help cure your skin disease. And then at the bottom, it was like, no one is permitted in the bathhouse with skin disease.
Right, yeah, which was, I'm like, wait, wasn't that kind of like the point?
The whole point.
So I'm kind of assuming they mean like, if you have like arthritis or yeah. like maybe like psoriasis, something that can't be like passed on to another person. I don't know. That would be my
general
guess.
Aches and pains is what they're really going
yeah,
for.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so bathing etiquette. And this is kind of what you were alluding to.
Okay.
So both Sentos and Onsens, guests are expected to wash and rinse themselves thoroughly before entering the hot water. So like shampoo, soap, whole nine yards. Bathing stations are equipped with stools, faucets, wooden buckets, and toiletries like soap and shampoo. And most onsens also provide some type of removable shower heads for bathing convenience. So like the old person shower head thingy that we were talking
yes.
about. Entering the onsen while still dirty or with traces of soap on the body is socially unacceptable, like strictly taboo. Guests are not normally allowed to wear swimsuits in the bath. So guess what? You're bathing with people naked.
Yep. And they some so for men, you might be covering this, but for men, you are not allowed to bring any sort of cloth into the water. So you'll see most men have like a small towel that they put on their head so that when they get out of the water, they can hold it over their genitals region
yeah.
for like small bits of privacy modesty. For women, though, they are allowed to enter most springs with a larger towel to cover mm-hmm. more of themselves. Some are allowed to enter with like a yukata, just, you know, going in fully clothed. Women are allowed to break the bring cloth into the hot spring. It is strictly taboo for men.
Yeah. So I actually do have a little bit on that. Guests aren't allowed to wear swimsuits. Most modern onsens will require their guests to wear a swimsuit in their mixed baths. So if it's like a public bathhouse with mixed gender bathing, especially like within the city, a lot of places will require that you wear a bathing suit of some type. And like there are specific suits called Yugi that are designed specifically for this purpose.
Yeah.
So it's not like your average swimsuit that you would like buy and like go to the beach. This is specifically like a bathing suit.
Yes.
Which I use those two words interchangeably, but apparently in Japan, there is a difference. Onsen guests generally will bring a small towel, like Jonathan said, that's used like as a washcloth. So like you can use it like when you're scrubbing at the beginning. You can also use it as a little bit of modesty when walking between the washing areas. And some onsen will allow one to wear a towel into the bath, while others have posted signs like completely prohibiting this, saying that it makes it hard to clean the bathtub, which, you know, fair, probably true.
I went to a few.
You went to a few, yeah.
I went to a few of them. All of them strictly prohibited cloth in the bath.
Yeah. And that could also partly be because you went to ones for men.
Yep, and also in the city.
Yeah, and also in the city,
so
yeah.
The only one that we went to that wasn't in the city was the onsen resort
yeah.
in Ito.
And they have a bunch of different baths, and I'm assuming that because it is a resort, cleaning it is a priority, so they don't want anything that's going to make
yep.
it more difficult to clean.
Also, like you were mentioning, it's a more traditional resort.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, they have the traditional wooden style. They also
yeah.
do have the sunken-in pools. But
yeah, which was, like, the big baths, the public baths were, like, sunken-in pools, which was really cool. We were also, like, one of only two groups of foreigners that were there.
Yeah,
everyone else was absolutely Japanese.
It was very nice knowing that we went to a resort that is frequented by locals rather than tourists
yeah.
because we knew we were going to be in for a good time.
And I just happened to find it online randomly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey,
good job,
Kylie. Look at me go. Okay. So the last thing that I want to talk about with onsens is that not many of them are tattoo friendly.
Yes.
So, in fact, by 2015, around half, about 56% of onsen operators had banned bathers with tattoos from using their facilities at all. The original reason for this was to keep out Yakuza and members of other crime gangs who traditionally have elaborate full-body decorations. However, tattoo-friendly onsens do exist. Especially with the increase in foreign customers due to growing tourism, some onsens that previously banned tattoos are actually loosening their rules to allow guests with small tattoos to enter, either uncovered or if you can cover it with like a small bandage or like a flesh-colored wrap or something like that.
They also provide pretty large ones yeah. to cover yourself with if you have tattoos. Like, yes. they're large patches.
Yeah, so they have resources. So you can look for signage. Like, a lot of places, if they are, like, no tattoo, will say it on a sign somewhere. So if you use your little translate thing and look around, you'll be able to find it pretty easily. Or do what I did, which was I Googled it. Yep. I went online and was like, tattoo-friendly onsens. And I got a very nicely done list of, like, a bunch of places that people have been to and used before. And that's how I found the place we went to.
Mm-hmm.
And that is all I have on onsens and sentos.
Cool. So you briefly touched on how they had a deep connection with brothels and mm-hmm. of the like. And one thing that we very much found out, because we got a place in Kabukicho, as we've mm-hmm. mentioned, that means nothing to anyone who doesn't know things about Japan.
Nope.
It meant nothing to us when we first booked it. Kabukicho is the largest red light district in the world.
Surprise!
Yeah. So we were right in the middle of a bunch of love hotels yep. and boys clubs and yep. girls clubs.
And let me clarify, bigger than like the Moulin Rouge area of France.
Yeah.
Or like Paris, which is considerable.
It's huge. Like, yeah. You can walk around there all day and continue to find new places to go.
It was really cool.
It was. Kabukicho is also the quote-unquote theater district. Mm-hmm. So, like, right anywhere that wasn't the sex work area was, like, theater area. Yeah. So they had the big Toho theater there mm-hmm. that has the giant Godzilla statue on top of it. And when yeah. one of the days when we were walking around was the release day of the super important One Piece episode that was coming out yep. at the time, the yep. one that everyone was super hyped for. And there were 5 lines double wrapped around the Toho theater because they were playing it there that morning.
It was insane. It was yeah. the longest line I have literally ever seen, and we've been to Disney.
Yeah. To be fair, though, they went through that line very fast as soon as they opened.
Oh, yeah. They were so speedy. Like, I don't know how they did it. Did they, like, check tickets beforehand?
Everything in Japan was super efficient. We can chat about that later, but I wanted to quickly touch on a kind of, like, sad thing that we came across.
Oh, no.
It was when Luis and Kylie were getting tattoos. Kylie got a red panda tattoo on her shoulder. It came out super good.
Luis got a cicada and will not stop making the sound.
Yeah, anytime you see Luis's cicada tattoo, he will bring it into your face and go, ree, 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 yep. and make the cicada noise. The tattoo people found that absolutely hilarious when he, as soon as they finished the tattoo, they're like, okay, we're done. He's like, oh, man, it looks great. Ree,
ree, ree, ree. Immediately just into the guy's face, and he
laughed.
I thought he was going to pass out from laughing.
Yeah, he was having a good time. Anyways, while you guys were doing that, Kai and I were just looking for, like, local temples, and we found this one place that had a tombstone tablet that, as we were, like, walking through, it was kind of big, and it was out of place compared to everything else, and it was this tablet of a guy named Tokugawa Akitake. He was some general in a period of time. He was also a geographer and a poet, and there was all this information on him and whatever. But, like, it was really odd because that area was taken really well care of, but the rest of it wasn't. And, like, it was a big cemetery. We ended up finding out it was a cemetery, not, like, a regular shrine.
Oh, this is the one you told me about.
Yeah. So it was a cemetery, and it was, like, all overgrown and, like, I couldn't find too much information on this online. I wish I had taken pictures rather than just Google translating, but there mm-hmm. was a plaque out in this area that said that the majority of people who were buried there or who are being honored there, I'm not sure how much they actually buried versus cremate, and depending on what time period, that's very different.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
So it was a cemetery for people that were majority child slaves and sex work women.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, this is very interesting. And then we were like reading on the different plaques, like what they, like why they have this area for them or like what was going on. And it was basically, we had to go down this like little area that was like only a foot wide and totally overgrown to get to like all the different plaques that were explaining what was happening. But at one point, a different clan owned that area.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently this cemetery was to honor the child slaves and sex worker women for helping take back this area from this clan.
Mm-hmm.
And their assistance in this turf war, essentially, somehow, it didn't go into too much detail, but somehow their assistance in this turf war was aid enough to help recapture what we now know as modern day Shinjuku.
Mm-hmm.
And the cemetery was to honor them for their efforts in making Shinjuku, or taking Shinjuku back for that original clan.
Cool.
So it was really neat. But there was something terribly sad I found out while I was trying to find more information on this as I got home.
Oh, no.
That's not the only cemetery for sex workers. In fact, there are a lot of cemeteries for sex workers for a few different reasons. They weren't treated super well a long time ago.
Now.
Well, they have better protections there now.
In Japan, yes.
In Japan, yes. Which is what was really interesting, because if we talk about Kabukicho at all, it was kind of fun being in the red light district. There was a lot of cool things to do. But they weren't treated very well a long time ago. And then there was a period of time where they were treated a lot better. Not great, but better. And then it seemed to be surrounding wars. Japan would very frequently conscript sex workers for sex work for the soldiers, not to their will.
Yeesh.
And a lot of the times, people would go overboard and the sex worker would die, mm-hmm. and their bodies would literally just be tossed into temples for the people who ran the temples to deal with it, because they were sex workers, they didn't deserve proper burials, so they were wrapped in mats and tossed in areas. One of the places is called the Jokanji Temple. It was probably about 30 minutes north of where we were, mm-hmm. in Taito.
Okay.
That's kind of near, it's like one or two areas above Shinjuku to the north.
Okay.
And this place is locally known as the Throwaway Temple.
Oof.
For that reason. And there are, where is the number? Oops, I didn't write down the number. I got to open a link.
How dare you not do your one job, which is to find your fun facts.
Okay, found the number. This particular temple, and there are many of these, is home to 25,000 prostitutes who died.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Well, it may be fun in modern culture to talk about the red light district and everything and how it's much better protected and all that stuff. Yeah, Japan doesn't have a great history with sex work, despite them working towards a better history with sex work now. And even that's kind of tenuous because they kind of seem to flip-flop all the time as to whether or not they want to ban sex work or protect sex work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting relationship they have. At least as of right now, it seems to be pretty friendly towards sex work.
Yeah.
But yeah, it wasn't always. And this was a very interesting little shrine that we found. And then when I was looking online and found out that there are a lot more of these, it was like, oh, wow, this is an interesting piece of history.
That's really messed up.
Yeah, it's not good.
Oh, gosh.
There's one
way to bring down the mood.
That's fine. We're going to be all up from here. We got to have one sad history fact. History's not all sunshine and rainbows.
Isn't that usually my job?
Yeah.
Is to bring it down?
I wanted to take it back.
Okay, fair.
And you want to be real sad, we'll end it this last quote. There was some account, I don't have good citing for it because mm-hmm. there was a translated Japanese page that doesn't exist in English and everything. But when talking about specifically the Jokanji Temple, they found a record at some point of a sex worker writing in a diary saying that she was born to live in hell and will be thrown away in Jokanji Temple.
Yikes.
That's how known it was that's where you go to die if you live in that area and you're a sex worker.
Jeez.
Yeah. So take anything we say positive about, Kabukicho with a slight grain of salt. It's good now, but we're not going to coat over the fact that the history with sex work in Japan is very bad.
I'm just going to go cry in a corner now. This is really depressing.
One thing else is it's not just Japanese people who were intentionally doing this.
Mm-hmm.
It very much, especially after World War II, Americans forced the government to provide them sex slaves.
Mm-hmm.
Americans did, like, generals and military, and that was part of the just trading that we did with Japan once we kind of told them to get rid of their military, and we were like, oh, now that you don't have any really way to defend yourselves, like, give us your women.
Yeah.
And that contributed to a lot more deaths of sex workers.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yep. So anyways, we will skip on from that.
All right. Well, now that I'm super depressed.
I mean, you brought up the sex work.
But you can't blame me.
Kabukicho was a lot of fun, though. And honestly, a lot of the places, like me and Luis were checking them out, and most of them are just companionship.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority are just companionship. So you, like, go to a bar and you pay up front. This is a cool thing for, like, the entirety of Japan, really.
Yeah.
Most drinking establishments, if that's the only thing they're there for, you pay a cover to get in, which was somewhere between, like, 7 to 14 USD.
Mm-hmm.
And once you're in, you're there for an hour where you can drink as much as you want.
Yep.
It is unlimited drinks for an hour after you pay a cover. I can only assume that the Japanese people don't drink nearly as much as the Americans, because we drank a lot.
Yes.
There was a lot that we could get through. They weren't, like, watering down anything either.
Jeez.
Because, like, you would expect if this was a thing in the U.S., they would water down the drinks.
I mean, absolutely.
Even clubs, like, water down their drinks that you're paying for individually in the U.S. So, it was very interesting. But anyways, you go into these places and they assign one of the hostesses to go and sit at your table. And, like, if you're alone, they literally just pretend to be your girlfriend. It's kind of like a rental girlfriend service.
Yeah.
And they just sit and talk to you. It's literally just keeping you company. And, like, we were talking to them. We're like, so what are some of the places that we shouldn't go to around here? What are some places that you recommend?
Like,
just we're trying to get a feel of, we don't want to do anything illegal, but we want to have fun here. Mm-hmm. Where are the safe zones?
Yeah.
And she was telling us that actually right now, any of these hostess bars, it is not legal for them to remove any articles of clothing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's literally just companionship that is what the majority of the main runway of Kabukicho is. Now, there are places that do things more like a typical strip club in the United States.
Yeah.
But we're a family-friendly podcast. We won't really go into it, but it was just interesting because it was harder to find those, but they weren't, like, seedy or gross, and they weren't hidden, and, like, it was just harder to know which ones they were.
Yeah.
And it was just interesting because I don't think any of the places that we went to I would consider, like, dirty or gross or, like, any of the things you would normally associate with a strip club in the U.S. Like, being kind of grimy and stuff. It was all very high class. And even, like, talking to some of the people while we were walking around, they're like, oh, yeah, like, those fancy thing, the fancy strip clubs that people go to, those are, like, just high class people go there. Like, only people with money go there. Everyone else just kind of goes to the different, like, themed companion bars and maid cafes and all of that stuff.
That's cool.
So it was interesting.
Yeah. What else did we want to talk about?
Well, I have something about the arcades because, boy, did we do a lot with arcades. did you have anything else? Did you have anything about, like, or actually, I should probably do my topic because you just did your long one on the onsen.
Yeah, so do the arcade.
So we're going to do arcades because also, we'll segue this way, in Kabukicho, there were arcades everywhere.
So much fun.
There were so many arcades. And it turns out that that's kind of because Shinjuku's, like, almost the birthplace of arcades, like traditional modern arcades.
Cool.
So I'll go into that a little bit, but before we do, let's go way back.
Oh dear.
What do you think is the year that first inspired the creation of arcades in Japan? Pick a year, any year.
1910. I don't know.
Wow, you were way closer than I thought.
Oh.
Likely Japan's arcades were inspired around 1903.
Oh.
And Japan arcades were inspired by playgrounds that they would build on top of department store rooftops.
Oh.
So they would build these playgrounds on top of department stores, probably just so, like, parents could, like, drop their kids off there while they shopped and walked around. That was the original inspiration. They had, like, wooden toys up there and, like, some push cart type things or swings. And that's not where the arcade part starts, but that's the origin of where we're going to get this cultural shift from.
Okay.
So, or one of the things that happened was all the way forward into 1955, where a material rubber manufacturer called Nakamura Manufacturing decided to place two brand new coin-operated riding horses on top of the Yokohama department store.
Okay.
So that was a departure from what was normally up there, because normally it was just like a wooden rocking horse and like, you know, manual push entertainment in these playgrounds. So these were like the first coin-op rocking horses.
Right.
And they decided after doing that, that they kind of wanted to stay in the amusement business. So they started making a bunch of other coin-op type rides on the rooftops, including coin-op train rides and like car racing. That apparently there was one account that I saw that said that they actually connected the tops of the rooftops
to
other like areas. I mean, we, because we were there, we know the roofs are all very close together.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, they are.
The buildings are really tight and it's an endless city.
Yes.
If you join our other show's Discord, we actually posted a bunch of pictures in there if you wanted to see like some of the pictures from this trip.
Yep.
That's the Halfwits and Failed Crits Discord. You can find that in the show notes on that show.
Yeah.
But we posted a bunch of pictures there. You can see that it's just endless city, that whole place. So they would have like these little car areas that kids could race cars on the rooftop. It was guided rail. It was coin op, but it was racing. And this company, the Nakamura Manufacturing, they ended up getting, kind of big in Japan with all the different coin ops they were making. Big enough that they caught the attention of Disney in 1959. And Disney hired them to make a lot of the likenesses for the theme parks of all of the Disney characters.
That is very cool.
So I couldn't find any more detail on that, but I know that Nakamura Manufacturing made a lot of money on this deal. I can only assume that some of the original pieces in the Disney theme parks, like, are from there.
That's
still
really
like
neat.
I would imagine, like some of the oldest rides, like Small World. Some of those animatronics might be coin ops that Nakamura Manufacturing made that they just made it so that it wasn't, you didn't have to put a coin in, they would just move.
Oh.
I can only assume that that's what it is, because there's not too much detail on this, and we know that they made a lot of money doing this.
Wow, that is quite impressive.
So with that funding, they were able to expand their coin op into a different kind of entertainment, which is where we get to Torpedo Launcher, which will be a lot more recognizable to people in the arcade space as the game called Periscope. It was like a shooting gallery, but it was a coin-op game. So it was one of the first cabinet-type games that Japan had.
Okay.
Pinball machines existed in the U.S. a lot further before that. Like, pinball machines existed in the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. But this was like the first like game that you could have in a cabinet. And it was in 1966. And the company would go on to make a lot of these style games. And eventually, Nakamura Manufacturing would decide to split from its industrial rubber manufacturing. So Nakamura Manufacturing still exists.
I'd already forgotten that it manufactured rubber.
Yeah, they were just a rubber manufacturer. They split off, and Nakamura Manufacturing continued to do its industrial rubber, its furniture, its benches, stuff like that. I don't know how well they're doing. We didn't see many benches there.
We didn't see very many benches. No, we didn't.
And then the other half of the company became Namco.
Oh!
So Bandai Namco, if you've ever heard, like Namco, extremely famous, probably most famously, the creators of Pac-Man.
Well, dang.
So they started as a rubber manufacturer that transitioned into coin ops on top of department stores and eventually made Pac-Man and many other games that you're very well aware of.
That is not the trajectory that I expected.
Yeah, well, this isn't going to be the trajectory you expected either.
Okay.
Actually, I've got a quick aside before we go down that other unexpected trajectory. The quick aside is that the year after they made Periscope, Sega would also make Periscope, but they would market it to the United States instead of Japan.
Oh, okay.
And there was very little copyright law going on in Japan at that point, so they're just like, well, Namco's got all of this here, so we're going to do it somewhere else. So they made Periscope. It was not exactly the same. It was slightly different, and they sold it to the U.S. So if you ever played Periscope in the U.S., it came from Sega.
Yep.
And not only that, it was so popular that Periscope is the reason why many coin-op arcade games in the U.S. have a 25 cent per play fee.
Okay.
Because that wasn't common until Periscope went over, and then everyone unified around the 25 cent, the quarter, fee for playing per play. And like pinball would go on to like very quickly try and like squeeze the market because they were getting pushed out by video games. So pinball would go up to like 50 and 75 cents a play. And even some people were like, we're going to charge a dollar per play for pinball. And that contributed to the vast and very quick decline of pinball, especially in the face of video games. So the quarter payment per play really is what kept those style of games alive and around. And that
That's
was all because of Periscope.
I never knew that. That is very cool.
So now back over to Japan.
To our new other confusion for Kylie thing.
Yes. So with like games like Periscope gaining popularity, more and more companies tried to rush to make new gallery or cabinet games. And one in particular was a vodka and vending machine importer.
Excuse me?
Yep. So they decided that they wanted to get their hands on the gaming market. It seems like just industrial manufacturers in Japan were just like, we kind of want to do something fun. And I don't blame them.
You know what? Fair. That is a fair thing.
So they started to get into the business and became a big competitor of Nakamura Co. Even before it became Namco, they were starting to try and get in there. And eventually, this company would kick off what we would call the like arcade cabinet and video game boom in Japan. And this company is Taito.
Ah.
Taito being the place that we played almost all of our arcade games at. We would check a bunch of the different arcade areas, and then we would always end back at Taito.
Yep. It was like five floors. It was amazing.
So Taito, they started off the arcade boom because I did not know this. I should have, probably. They created Space Invaders.
Oh.
And Space Invaders is what really kicked off people's obsession with arcade cabinet and video games.
That's funny.
It was so popular that the places where people... So it wasn't called an arcade. The original name for arcades were Invader Houses. Because the only game in them was Space Invaders and maybe some of these other older gallery-style cabinets.
Oh my gosh, that's funny. Invader Houses. I love it.
An Invader House was eventually renamed to Taito Station. Which is the exact place that we were at. And now it makes a whole lot more sense why they had the Space Invader alien on the building.
On the building.
I just assumed that it was just being like, games are here. Space Invader. No, they made it.
It all makes sense. It all comes together.
And not only that, their first Invader House was the Shinjuku one that we were at.
What?
Yeah.
Well,
so that,
well
that
then.
Was the birthplace of Space Invaders and arcades, was the Taito Station that we won most of our prizes at. And we won a lot of prizes.
We won so many prizes.
And that's like a defining feature of Japan arcades, is that they are not rigged.
Yeah.
They are difficult. You may have to put a few plays in to win them.
You
but
might need a little bit of skill.
There's a strategy to winning them, and the machine won't prevent you from doing so. In fact, while we were there, it seemed like the machines would figure out if you were losing too frequently and force a win so that you had a good time.
There were a couple of times, like especially on like the cheaper ones, where like if I was very much determined that I wanted to get like, I got like this cute little like galaxy octopus thing, and like it was a crane game. So like, you know, much like crane games in the US, like it would go, it would do the thing, it would start to pick it up, and then you could just feel it like loosen up, right? And drop it. There were a couple of times where like when I pressed the button and it grabbed it, I could hear like the click of it locking in place, and I'm like, oh,
it was like, you're winning this one.
Okay. And it would not even drop it a little bit. It was just like locked in there. Cause like sometimes with them, when you would win, it was because like it dropped it in just the right place and it fell over the edge or something like that.
And that's the skill of it, is you try and get them to fall or lean in ways that they're more likely to fall down the prize hole.
Right. There were a couple of times where it just fully locked, picked it up, pulled it over, and then opened and dropped it. And I'm like, oh, that was a pity.
So just to finish off our little aside about arcades, we can talk about like what we did at arcades and stuff we won afterwards. But to finish the prepared fun facts here, to put into scale how popular the Invader houses and eventually arcades Taito Station would become. And there's obviously a lot more competitors. Taito Station was just the major one.
Yeah.
There were over 26,000 arcades in Japan only 8 years after people started finding them popular.
Oh, that was fast.
Yeah.
That was very fast.
Not only that, it caused a financial crisis because the government ran out of 100 yen coins.
We kept running out of 100 yen
coins. We kept running out of 100 yen coins.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so with the government not being prepared for something to wildly take storm like this, they had a shortage of 100 yen coins.
That's funny.
All of the 100 yen coins were in the Invader
the
houses. In the machines, yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Wow. I did not expect that.
Yeah, so if you go to Japan, make sure you go to the arcades because there's
so
a bunch
fun.
Of different type of games. There's a lot of really cool prizes. There's a lot of exclusive prizes.
Yeah,
there.
We got a couple of those.
And part of the reason why some of them are exclusive and the reason why the quality of these prizes are so good is that Taito is still a toy manufacturer. Everything in those arcades are coming out of Taito manufacturing.
Yeah. I mean, like, so, like, I, being myself, I focused on winning plushies.
Yep. Kylie won a lot of plushies.
I won a lot of plushies. And, like, they are good.
Yeah.
Like, they are nothing like the plushies that you get from, like, a traveling fair or anything like that. Like, when you do, like, the arcade games at those type of things. Or not arcade, but, like, those stupid, like,
yeah.
Pop the balloons and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Carnival
these are
games.
Like these are like the kind of stuffed animals that you purchase.
Yeah, and honestly, some of them, like you got one that was Pommy from the
yeah,
new Pokemon
games.
I'm
looking at him right now.
Like the Pommy is better than you could buy here, like
oh,
out
yeah.
of a store.
Oh my gosh, it's big. I think it maybe cost. I think I got that one after like I don't know, maybe it was like 10 tries.
10 plays, yeah.
So yeah, that was like 1,000 yen. It was $7.
Yeah, $7 for something that like
you would,
I would
probably
spend say
like
40 bucks.
Yeah.
$40 plush. And that was really typical is we typically won the prizes before we hit what they would cost.
Yeah. The very first thing that we won out of any of the crane games was an otter plushie. And I won it much to my glee because up until then we didn't realize that you really could win things.
Yeah.
Because like you could see, I would see people with them, but like I never saw anyone win it like while we were there.
Right.
So when the first time it fell out, I was like in tears. I was so happy. Luis and I were sprinting around. I think it was Taito Station.
It was Taito Station.
It was Taito Station. We were sprinting through it, screaming for Jonathan because we couldn't believe we had won something. And then we all just kind of looked at each other like, you can actually win things here. Oh my gosh. And then we scattered.
And the otter she got is like the size of her body.
Yes.
And it was picked up by a crane game claw. Like,
yeah.
They're no joke. Like, if you do it right, you can win.
Yes. It was. And like, there were prizes that were like huge too. Like, there were some plushies and stuff. Like, one of the places we went to had that super sized one, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And like, that one was really hard. And like, the plays at that place were more expensive. So we didn't do that.
Yeah.
But like, it was literally like a 5 foot tall, like stuffed animal.
I will say, if you go, they just recently, like this year, built Kabukicho Tower, which is super cool looking, but it's easily 5 to 10 times more expensive than any of the other arcades.
Yeah.
And some of their stuff there, you can't actually play without having like an arcade card to tap.
Right.
Whereas all of the other places, you could use 100 yen coins.
Yeah.
And like they had both at the other places,
yeah,
like Taito Station. But Kabukicho Tower like required you to get a card, and that was kind of a pain. It's not, I would say it wasn't tourist friendly. So as fun and pretty and new as Kabukicho Tower was, stick with the tried and true Taito Station.
Oh, yeah. That and the one that was like across the street from the Kabukicho Tower that was like
Go-Go?
Go-Go, yeah.
No, Gigo.
Gigo. It's literally across the street. Like you stand in the opening of Gigo and can look at Kabukicho Tower. And we like won a bunch of stuff in that one, too.
Yeah. I mean, if you go to that other Discord for our other game, you can see some of the pictures. And we have a lot. Like, our table that we record on we filled half of it with all of our winnings. And like, yep. I primarily went for figures because like I like anime figures and stuff like that. And a lot of the ones there are exclusive or abstract or, you know, just like if you were to buy them from here, you would probably pay like $300 for them just mm-hmm. because shipping is going to be a lot of money.
Yeah.
But like I won Saleta from
Witch
from Mercury, the new Gundam series that mm-hmm. came out like a year ago. And that was on my second or third try.
Yeah, that one you got really fast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay. And
all right.
That specific machine was like a hand pusher where yeah. like the pushing mechanism is exactly the same size as the hand that you're pushing with. It has mm-hmm. like just a tiny bit of room on either side. So it's supposed to be really hard. And like here, if you ever played a hand pusher, because they do have some of them here, they're very rare. They're always programmed to have a delay from when you press the button so mm-hmm. that you can't ever really line it up right because the delay is not necessarily
even every time.
But here, it was completely even on like a stepper motor. It had its encoder, so it knew exactly how far it was going. So every time you played it, it was consistent. So it was difficult, but consistent.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't difficult for me.
Jonathan got asked to leave.
I got asked to not play that one again. Because I won 5 in a row. And apparently they had a little sign in Japanese that said,
Don't win more than five in a row.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they were like, you need to stop now.
Because it's one of those that is skill-based. And it's not like a claw machine where they intentionally are like very loosely trying to pick it up so that you have to manipulate it over. Or a UFO catcher that you have to take the little two pinching claws and like push a box to a side so that you can get it to fall down.
Yeah.
Because some of them are like, they have a grate. And the entire machine itself is the prize-winning like
area,
but there's a grate that you have to get your prize to fall through.
Mm-hmm. And like they're specifically lined up so that like it's really difficult to get it through. Like you have to get it tilted right and like turned right and stuff.
And if you get it into a certain tilt, it's
dead. Impossible. Yeah.
However, unlike America, if you ever get something stuck in a really bad spot in an arcade in America, they will sit there and laugh and let people spend their money trying to, you know, get the thing back into the right spot. And they'll make their money because that's just what Americans do.
Yep.
In Japan, any of these arcades that we went to, if even an employee saw that it looked like it was in a bad spot, they would ask you to step away from the machine and they would fix it for you.
Yeah. Sometimes they would like completely reset it, but sometimes like if it was like all the way at the other end or something like that, like you had clearly gotten it like just almost to the area, but it had gotten quite a little bit wrong. They would just kind of like retilt it for you so that you could keep going.
Yeah.
Like it had never happened.
There was one that I think I actually didn't tell you about because it was on the last day and we were all really tired, but there was this girl who was trying to get a like dog plushie
mm-hmm.
and it was in a spot that had like plushie logs as the floor, so it was harder to grab because
how I got my peach one from, and that was a pain in the butt
because the catcher would grab onto the log instead of the prize,
and the log is like glued down but not completely.
It's not glued. I know they're not glued after this experience.
Okay.
Because she was having such a hard time and she looked so defeated. One of the employees walked over, opened up the thing, and he stacked the logs into a big tower and put the prize she wanted at the top of it and just said, hit it. So she knocked the tower over and he asked her not to take the plushie logs so that he could put them back in the machine.
Oh my gosh,
but
that's so funny.
She got
funny.
To knock the tower over to get her prize. So and like
oh my gosh.
The culture there is people, they know that you're supposed to be able to win these. They typically like random people will come up and like tell you if they think that if you do something a little bit different, you could possibly win it. Like they'll try and instruct you.
Yeah. And people will cheer when you win too.
And that's what
like
I was
straight
getting
up
to.
Like
yeah.
like when you win something, there's usually a couple of people around you who will cheer.
And those people are people who like got a prize that they wanted to come for the day and they don't have any money left or like their friends are still playing or whatever. And they'll just walk around and like wait for people who are like really close to winning something.
Yep.
Like everyone will gather around you and as soon as you win, they're all like, yeah.
And I fully did that too at one point. Like you were still trying to get something and I was bored, so I was wandering around and I like watched a couple of people win something and I found myself actually like being like, oh, good job. And then I'm like, they don't know a single thing I'm saying. But
it didn't matter
because
everyone was excited.
Yeah,
it was
exactly.
Just a good time. Go to the arcades, even if you're not like a big arcade person or like they have like regular arcade games normally on the top floors rather than the and they have signs that say exactly what you can win at every level.
Pictures and everything so that like even us dumb Americans could figure it out. on that note, on this happy note, I think we should probably wrap up.
I think we should wrap up. Maybe we'll remember
maybe
some other things.
Yeah,
maybe if we remember other things that we want to talk about, we'll come back for a part two.
Yeah.
I guess like a quick fun fact, since we're at the end of the episode.
Ooh.
I tried to look up what like different things about mochi, because I love mochi.
Oh,
and we got to have some really good mochi in Japan.
And crepes. The crepes were amazing.
The crepes were amazing. We could maybe do a part two. We'll think about it.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
No,
it'll probably
be
after we come back, but with regular episodes for you.
Yeah.
But I tried to look up a bunch of stuff about mochi, and there's two funny things that I wanted to mention. First of all, I thought mochi was complicated. It's not. They literally just put steamed rice in a bowl and hit it. There's
okay.
Nothing. There's nothing else in mochi. Like some people add sugar, and that's it. And it's just smashed rice. Like that. The big mochi hammer is literally just a replacement for mortar and pestle.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny.
So
okay.
You just mortar and pestle rice, and you've got mochi. Very easy if anyone wants to try it at home.
Okay, maybe someday we'll try that.
And mochi was used as kind of like a not necessarily like a teething, but more of like. You know, something for babies to do,
right,
like in
yeah.
very old times, probably still today. I was reading about the old,
like especially
stuff.
Frozen.
Yeah, so
just
they
gum on it.
It's pretty much gum. It's pretty much rice gum. So they would like take a small bit of the mochi as they were pounding it and like give it to toddlers so that they could just kind of munch on
it. Oh, that's funny.
And then the funny part that I was going to get to was I found the Wikipedia page for mochi is. It's like, oh, mochi is a Japanese rice cake made of mochi gome, is short grain glutinous rice, blah, 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 which it says glutinous, but I think they just mean sticky because everywhere else for the rest of this thing, it says mochi is gluten free.
Huh.
So I think they just mean sticky rice. I don't know. But it's, just water and sugar and rice. And it's like, oh, well, it's eaten all year round. Mochi is a traditional food for the Japanese New Year, and it's commonly sold and eaten during that time. And then the next paragraph, which is still part of the introduction to mochi, is mochi is a multi-component food consisting of polysaccharides, lipids, and protein in water. Mochi is a heterogeneous structure of amylopectin, gel, starch, grains, and air bubbles. The rice used for mochi has a negligible amylose content and a high amylopectin level, producing a gel-like consistency. The protein of the japonica rice used to make mochi is higher than the standard short-grain rice. What? Why did it get so science-y in that second paragraph?
I'm just like deer in the headlights
it's
right now.
It's so science. And like the rest of the Wikipedia article is so science-y.
It's because whoever wrote that intro was like, nobody's going to understand what the rest of this article says. I'm going to make it for dummies.
Yeah, I mean, like they have like pictures of different like ceremonies because mochi is a very like ceremonial thing that they eat. But there's just so much on like the actual chemistry of mochi in this Wikipedia article. I was just both slack-jawed and kind of like chuckling at the same time.
Oh my gosh.
Who put this much effort into
mochi?
Pounded rice. That's it.
That's insane.
Anywho. We don't have to go through our whole thing. Just thank you all for listening. Thanks for enjoying our little Japan side show here. I hope you liked it and we had fun recording this. Maybe we'll think about other ways that we can do little bonuses like this every once in a while.
Yeah. And if you're interested in a part two, let us know because we absolutely have more that we can talk about.
Yeah. All of our contact information is down in the show notes.
Yeah.
So
email.
Let us
message
know.
Us, whatever.
Or if you go to the Discord for Halfwits and Failed Crits to go see all the pictures that we took.
Say we want Halfwit History Japan Part 2.
Yeah.
Demand it.
Demand it.
We will deliver, hopefully.
I guess we'll see you later. So sayonara isn't real. What is... Jane.
Jane.
Jane. Me.